I think we decided from the previous hour that you could hear me more clearly if I were speaking into the microphone. So this time I will. The topic that we have today about getting along with other people, managing our relationships effectively, and the words emotional maturity are enormous topics about which we could speak for a really long time. And there are topics that are also extremely close to everyone's heart, because everything comes down to whether or not we're loved, whether we feel loved, whether the people we care about are kind to us. We may spend most of our energy doing other things, but our happiness is enormously dependent on how we get along. And even our success, and with we always are working with other people. Do I hear a strange sound with this? So what should I do? Should I give it up? Is it too much? It's all right? Okay, if it's all right with you all, I just keep hearing it, but I can't tell what it feels like to you. Even our success in business and in work and so on has a lot to do with how we get along. Many careers are ruined because there comes to be a feud and one goes after the other and that's the end of that. I was reading the life of Nelson Mandela, of all things. You know, he passed away not too long ago, and just the terrible cycle he had with his wife and how she waited for him all those years in prison, and then he came out, and then it was a miserable reunion, and they had a divorce, and it was just like, to my way of looking at it, you know, there are so many different areas. He succeeded so extraordinarily in so many ways, but that part of his life was still always very difficult, and it caused him enormous pain. And so it's very worthwhile, whatever stage we are in life and whatever we're doing, to recognize how important this is. In the group that I was talking to before, which I think the median age of that group was younger, closer to just getting out of school and so on, I was talking about how hard everyone works in school in this country and how intense you are about your exams and all of these things, and how almost none of your education deals with getting along with other people. Learn.
Sorry to interrupt.
This is too much. Great. Do you want me to try the other one?
No, I think.
The one that standing one? I don't know. Can you hear me? Can you hear me well enough? I did the other one without a microphone. It was just a suggestion that I should try. Can you hear me well enough?
Yes.
Yeah, the buzzing is annoying me too, so, all right. Did you have a thought? Is that one going to work better? Or is all of this unnecessary? Okay, let's try this one and see if it buzzes. I'd like to put it here so I don't have to stand behind. I'm not such a big person, and if I stand behind such a big thing, then... Okay, does this one work for me at all? Is that better? Okay, sounds more nice to me too. But how almost none of our education really teaches us how to get along with people, how to master our own emotions. Even the concept of emotional maturity is simply assumed. It's assumed that when we get to a certain chronological age, we will also have a corresponding emotional maturity, which alas is not true. And we see it all the time. We see people in high positions who behave like children, and naughty children. Or we find ourselves, much to our own dismay, in our own personal or business lives, behaving like naughty children and not even know where it's coming from. We have in our communities, our ashram communities, we've started schools, and we call those schools Living Wisdom Schools. The friend who is running the video camera for me today is a founding student of the school in my community, and he graduated from that school. And what we realize is we approach education, I'll just say a little bit about it because it's worth thinking about this. Our system is called Education for Life. Our version of it is called Living Wisdom Schools. But the idea is a really simple one, which is you can't fragment a human being. You have to deal with all parts of a person, and education ought to deal with all parts of a person. The Indian system is remarkably fragmented. People talk to me about aspects of parenting in their children's exams, and honestly, I have to say I don't even know where to begin to comment. Because once you fragment human beings to that extent, how do you fix a piece of it? You have to start over from the foundation, and I believe in time the whole thing will gradually rectify itself, but it's a big ship to turn. So in the meantime, we're trying to make up pieces of it. Now, in the Education for Life system of education, which is also as academically rigorous as any, in fact, more so, because when you train a person on all levels, they're more competent on all levels. Their emotions are cooperating, their willpower is cooperating. But the founder of that system, who is my spiritual teacher, Swami Kriyananda, he's an American. Donald Walters is his American name. He wrote Education for Life under that name. He described the goal of education as true maturity, which is an interesting concept which I haven't seen in any other system. And then he defines true maturity as the ability to relate to realities other than one's own. And I'm going to spend a little time explaining that because it's absolutely key to our getting along with other people. Most of us live in the world that we're most familiar with, which is me. I, me, mine. My needs, my desire, my perspective. Men tend to think like men. Women tend to think like women. I'm married. I have been for more than 30 years. I also have done a great deal of marriage counseling over the years, and I have worked hard to find a way to be harmonious with my husband, I think with some success, but it wasn't automatic. And at a certain point, there was a pattern that I began to see in my own relationship that began to appear in the counseling work that I was doing. Mostly it's women who initiate marriage counseling. My guru says that the success or failure of marriage is dependent on the woman, not in the way that it's sometimes interpreted in this culture that the woman simply bears all the suffering. But Master says it's more like, because women are more sensitized emotionally, they can determine the weather in the home, so to speak. And all I wanted from my husband was that he just be a little more in touch with his feelings, that he talk to me about his feelings just a little bit more, that he just be a little more interested in all the trivia that interested me. And then it began to appear in my counseling the same way, and I began to realize that all the discontented wives that I was talking to wanted their husbands to be a lot more like them, which is just to make that tiny shift that is the difference between a man and a woman, as simple as that. And I remember talking to my husband about it at one point, like, don't you know what I want from you? He said, yes. I said, well, why don't you cooperate with me? He said, because I don't even think it's attractive to be like that. He said, you think it's such a good thing, but I was born to be a man, and I don't want to be a woman. Kriyananda, my teacher, years ago, we were publishing these, we still publish them, these small books, Secrets of Success, Secrets of Prosperity, Secrets of Inner Peace, of Meditation, of Happiness, 30 aphorisms that you won a day for the month. And when we first published them, which was many years ago, no one else had yet thought of such a thing. Now you see many of them. Oddly, we were the first ones to think of it. We're making lots of money, which we needed, our publishing company needed. And the salesman said, most of these books are bought by women, so if you would write a book called Secrets of Women, it would be a real bestseller. Kriyananda is a man. He said, how can I write such a book like this? But he has a very fluid consciousness. The next morning, he said he woke up and he just had the consciousness of a woman. And for the next 3 days, he wrote this book about women and how you can be the best if you're going to be female. Very nice book. And during that time,
sometimes the phone would ring or people would try to draw him into the habitual discussions. His answer was, I can't respond now because I'm in a female state of mind and I can't respond like a man as I would need to do that. So then after all of this was done, and women, you have to appreciate, I'm a woman, so I'm going to say this now, and he was the most impartial person, gender neutral, I would call him. I mean, he had transcended gender, really. But he said to us women, he said, for the last 3 days, he said, I was just living in female consciousness. It was terrible. He said, it's just one wave of emotion after another. How do you stand it like that? Now, I'm saying all this humorously and seriously at the same time, back to true maturity. What happens to us is that whatever we are, we tend to think of that as right and natural. And when you're 20 and you look at your parents who are 50, they seem really, really old, just really old. And it just seems impossible that they could understand anything about what it is to be 20. And when you're 50, you tend to think, what is wrong with these 20-year-olds? Don't they have any sense? Can't they see anything about what's going on? And we all just keep switching around, and wherever we're standing, that's the one that we know, and we have a tendency to relate only to that. And Americans relate to being Americans, Indians relate to being Indians. I mean, just name it, all the problems in the world, look at them. The worst problems in the world are when people take what they are and decide that is the only reality there is. There is a notable lack of true maturity on our planet, and a great deal of the trouble is caused by that. People cannot relate to realities other than their own. It causes us global, political, and personal problems. You know, I'm trying to be a good wife to my husband by trying to make him into me. And he points out that he actually, much as he loves me, does not want to be me and was not born to be me. And it's not even the direction of his personal growth is not to be me. It's in the direction that he himself has his particular trajectory to work out. And I learned slowly from being a young wife to being a more mature one that if I really want to be a friend to him, what to speak of being a wife, just to be a friend, I have to feel what it's like inside of him. You know, what are his actual priorities? What is really possible for him? Where does his fulfillment and happiness lie? And even on one occasion, I was ragging on him for one thing or another, and we happened to be traveling at the time with Swami Kriyananda. And for some reason, I don't know how, Swami became aware of whatever was going on. Bear in mind, our marriage has been essentially harmonious all the way through, so I'm talking about small things, relatively speaking. Some not so small, but small, relatively speaking. And I was urging some change upon my husband, and I said to Swami, don't you think it would be good if he did what I asked, meaning whatever it was I wanted of him? Swamiji was extremely fair. He said, yes. He said, it would actually, you know, be a good direction for him. But he has to want it for himself. So he gave us both truths, that my perception was not inaccurate, but I was not exercising true maturity. I was relating to it only from my point of view from the outside, and I hadn't even bothered to try to feel it from his point of view and what it felt like. So the practice, the first practice of really getting along with other people is the simplest and most obvious thing in the world. They're not you. And even if they're your son, your daughter, your mother, your father, your boss, your employee, there's a clue here. You know, they look different. They have a different name. They're moving through a different reality. They're not you. And the more mature we are, the less self-centered. You know, what makes a child is just how incredibly self-centered children are. Small children just can't even conceive of the fact that their parents have anything to do except take care of them. And children get so excited about so many things. My friend's young son used to be very frustrated being a small boy. Just the fact of being a small boy just annoyed him. And he often had tantrums for no particular reason except that he wasn't grown up and he couldn't do anything and it bothered him. And his mother would treat him kindly but firmly. And when he would have his tantrum, she would just put him in his room. They had a habit. He would be placed in his room and she would latch the door so he had to stay in there. And he would be allowed to have his screaming fit for a while. And once when she put him in his room, he screamed for a while and then it got very quiet and she opened the door. She said, "Darling, are you done?" "Not quite, Mommy," he said like that. So she shut the door and he screamed a little bit longer. And he was just screaming because his world wasn't the way he wanted it to be. He couldn't conceive of the fact that he was only four, that he wouldn't be four forever, that there's appropriate realities for being four, and that gradually, you know, everything would come to him, and now he is a grown man with children of his own. All of these things happen. When we're immature, the only perspective we can see is exactly the one that we have. I mean, that is the definition of immaturity. That's what makes a four-year-old immature. You say, "You have to go to school." "No, I don't." "You have to eat vegetables. You can't just eat cake." "No, I don't." "You won't grow up strong if you don't eat healthy food." "Yes, I will." That's how children are. They just declare reality, and they don't have the maturity to see the perspective. Well, as we grow older, we can dissemble more. We understand how to play the game a little bit. But a lot of people never really cognize how every individual has a center point from which their own personal growth is going to take place. I think of this, we have an apple tree in our backyard where I live in California. And I eat the apples, I'm very fond of the apples. And of course at the center of many of those apples there's an apple seed. And I can be sitting on the porch eating the apple, looking at the tree from which the apple came, and I realize that somewhere, at some point in time, there was an apple seed that must have made that apple tree. And you look at this tiny seed, and the whole potential is right there. But in order for that potential to be realized, that seed has to go through all these different stages of growth, doesn't it? And every one of those stages is absolutely essential. There's no way by my scolding it or urging that apple seed to get on with it that it can skip being a sapling or skip putting out its first branch or skip the flowers before the fruit comes. Every piece of it just has to grow from the inside out, according to whatever is possible given where it's standing. Now, everything living, and we're talking about other people, everything living blossoms from the inside out. That's the difference between living and non-living realities. Even an artist, I was in Florence and I saw the statue of the David. My husband's name is David, so it was sort of a nice thing to see. It's a really extraordinary piece of art. And no matter how many pictures you've ever seen of it, it has an amazing vibration. You know, Michelangelo really put something into that marble when he made it. Perhaps on the same trip, I also saw the original of the Mona Lisa, Leonardo da Vinci. I mean, how many of us? We've seen millions of pictures of the Mona Lisa and lots of cartoons of the Mona Lisa. And it doesn't look like much, but when you look at it, it has a certain life force. But both of those things did not grow from the inside out. The artist had his consciousness and he created it. Michelangelo had a huge piece of marble and he sort of worked with it, but it wasn't that it started from a seed and grew. That's the difference between living and non-living. All of us started with the sperm and the ovum, you know, just one cell, and then the soul energy is there and it expands into what we are. And even as we are now, we're aging. Most of us have nearly crested on the growing and we're on the other side of it. But nonetheless, it's still all from the inside. And so our personal development is exactly the same. And all of us have this deep-seated longing to be happy. There's really two forces that all human beings are following, all sentient creatures follow. We have a deep desire to escape pain, and we have a burning desire to experience happiness. We might call it pleasure. We might call it, you know, just a happiness if we call it that. We can advance it to joy. We can advance it to bliss. But it's directional in that sense. Even if you take a worm and poke it with something sharp, it'll try to get away. It's everything sentient is always trying to escape pain. And every decision that every one of us makes is motivated by our current understanding of what causes us suffering and what brings us joy. We advance through those stages. In America, there's something called a hostess cupcake, which is a chocolate cupcake with a white filling on the inside. As a child, it was just like, oh, heaven on earth when my mother would bring home a hostess cupcake. They seldom had sweets in our house. And so every time we got those, and these little plastic packages, and I can, you know, as a small child, they were really big in my hands. And I can just remember breaking them apart and licking out the white stuff and breaking off, you know. So when you're an adult person, you see one of those and you have your own money. I go and buy one, and it's just nauseating. I mean, it's beyond terrible. It was utterly uneatable. And it was nice to see that I'd progressed. My taste in music, my attitude toward clothes, my sense of a thousand things, they progress. But nonetheless, every time we're making a decision that always seemed like a good idea at the time, which looking back sometimes we wonder, but it always seemed like a good idea at the time this was going to bring me happiness and cause me to escape suffering. And if we really want to work with other people, we first of all, I believe, our ability to relate maturely to other individuals is exactly in proportion to how maturely we relate to ourselves. And if we are limited in our self-understanding, we often have a very difficult time seeing others. When I saw this topic and it had the word managing our relationships, I thought, well, the first relationship we have to manage is with our own selves. We have to have some idea of what's moving me. Where do I think happiness is coming from? What do I think is causing pain? Because speaking externally, we're with other individuals, they do something, it causes me pain, and the first response is, you did it to me. Because it happens sequentially in time, that you had an action, I had a pain. And it takes a great deal of true maturity to expand our understanding enough to ask ourselves, why did that cause me pain? What do I think is happening here? In the course of my life with my husband, I had to come to the understanding that why do I live in such a way that his actions can define my happiness? What makes me think he was born to conform to my idea of what's going to make me happy? That's the cycle I'm talking about. He needs to be more like me so that I will feel more comfortable. Where did this idea come from? You know, one goes through a lot of cycles of his actions and I suffer, so he must be causing it. But the first we have to manage is, why do I think that? Why am I allowing myself to be hurt? Have we all noticed that we have certain relationships where we're more vulnerable than others? Isn't that so? Where some people can speak to us in ways that just roll right off our back. It doesn't affect us at all. Others have the capacity to take away our happiness. And the first mature management has to realize, you know, my happiness is up to me. And it may well be true that somebody very close to me is behaving badly. I don't want to mislead you. It's not like everybody is good. Some people get their happiness by being mean to others. And they just really think they'll suffer less if they can dominate you. That's just a fact. It's a most unpleasant fact, but true maturity requires that we relate to realities other than our own. Wow, she's really mean. She really likes that. She really likes to treat me that way. But then the second question is to ask ourselves, do I have to respond? What brings me happiness? What causes me suffering? It may be a challenge, don't get me wrong on that one, to be able to manage our own responses sufficiently. But a great deal of what helps is to try to really understand who people are. When I was first starting out in the ashram where I've lived most of my life, my adult life, I had the job of working for Swami Kriyananda, who was the founder of the ashram and the spiritual leader. And I worked for him as a secretary, and one of the things that I had to do was to arrange appointments. Many people wanted to have appointments to see him, and they couldn't get to him except through me, which was made me both very popular and very unpopular, as you can well imagine. And he had to train me in how to relate to people. And he's a very, very loving and attentive person. And he had to make me understand that when I was representing him, I could not act as myself. I had to relate to people in the way that he would have related to them. And of course, I don't have his consciousness, and I couldn't do it on the level that he did. But I discovered such an interesting thing, that so much of the time, we never actually pay attention to each other. We talk without paying attention. And we never take that just very short energy that's required to calm and center ourselves sufficiently to actually really acknowledge that there's someone standing in front of you. I had a friend who, who talked so incessantly and so continuously, without any, I said later to my husband, I think she doesn't know there's anyone else out there. No matter where she is, she's just always in her own world talking. And she just has never quieted her mind long enough to actually realize that there's another reality in front of her. So when I was working for Swamiji in that particular role, much of the time, I could not give people what they wanted. But I found if I just took that time to actually be present with them, then after that, I could say almost anything, and we would be together. But if I didn't take that time, and they could hear that I was just answering from my reality, then it was always a struggle and unhappiness. The way Swamiji phrased it to me beautifully was, he said, you mustn't ever make people feel that my, Kriyananda's convenience is more important than their welfare. He said, and even if you have to say no, you must always make people feel that you would say yes if you could. And there's so much wisdom in that. Later on, when I myself had to manage people many years later, I had someone working for me who always wanted what she wanted, just always wanted what she wanted. And she didn't have a very practical sense of the overall reality. And she tended to take any rejection of her ideas as a solid rejection of her. I, in my early years as a manager of people, tended to feel threatened by people's impractical ideas. And I felt the need to protect. I thought I would be happier if I could protect myself from their incursions, okay? So whenever she would come to me with one of her impractical ideas, my first thought would be to say no. Just no. Because no, I didn't want to be bothered by her impractical ideas. Of course, that never sat well, always caused her to feel that she would be happier if she could either bully me down or talk me down, and we just had these impossible conversations. And at one point I finally realized, I remembered what Swami said to me. Even if I have to say no, I mustn't make people feel my convenience, my preferences are more important than their desires and their welfare. And I experimented with something that I've used ever since. She would come to me with one of her wildly impractical ideas, and I would respond first by saying, "Wow, that's really a creative thought. Wow, I never really would have thought of that before. Golly, let me think about this for a minute." You know, just here you are, you're another person. Wacky as I think your idea might be, it isn't wacky to you, or else you wouldn't have brought it to me. Just spending that 3 seconds to realize this is not me. This person has another reality, true maturity, to relate to reality other than my own. So from her point of view, this seems like a good idea. Let me go with her energy instead of contradicting her energy. I've watched how many conversations between people are people contradicting each other. One says one thing, the other contradicts it. One says another, the other contradicts it. And nobody is seeing either the goodwill or the sincere desire or the belief that this is a good idea. And all that happens is it escalates the separation. The slightest bit of just stepping in, and I started working with her in a completely different way. That's a really good idea. Let me see if we can think of a way to make that work. And just doing that, when we finally couldn't make it work, because almost all her ideas were impossible, but I began to realize that she just needed to be heard. She needed to be seen. You know, she needed to feel that I saw that she was a seed growing into a tree in her own way, you know? And Swami Kriyananda set an example for us that is very difficult to follow, which is his sense of happiness and contentment was complete within himself. And that's a very high level of spiritual freedom that most of us don't have. But I lived closely with that man for more than 40 years, so I know it's possible. And watching him not need anything from anyone and having a very deep desire to help people fulfill not their desires, but their true potential for happiness, it awakened me to the possibility. It awakened me because I experienced it, you know, in my reality. I experienced it from him. He's 22 years older than I am. He passed away last spring, so he's in the past tense now. But I was 22 when I met him, and he was 44 then, or 43. And I worked closely with him for many years, all through my 20s. I was cocky without having any basis for my confidence in my point of view. I was fearless in expressing it and ridiculously insistent on it on many, many occasions. And he was always supportive of my ideas. He didn't always accept them, but he always saw me. When I became myself, 25 years older than people who were working for me, I saw the temptation to assert seniority, age, knowledge, experience, or sheer impatience. And I had the realization that in all the years that I had worked with Swami Kriyananda, he had never once mentioned my age and never once mentioned my lack of experience. And I realized that was quite impressive. So I went to him and I thanked him next time I saw him. "Thank you, sir. I really appreciate that service that you did for me to allow me to grow without diminishing me." He accepted my gratitude, but with a look on his face that I knew that told me it wasn't the full story. And after he said that, then he commented to me. He said, "I never noticed your physical age." And then as a spiritual person, he said simply, "I always look into the eyes of a person and I see the consciousness. I just see the consciousness. Age is really ephemeral and no indication of wisdom." Now, there are several things there that are really wonderful. One is, as a technique, we can remember to not assert seniority over youth. But as another, it's just that simple thought. Who is this person? You know, who am I talking to? And if you're in any conversation, whether you're standing buying a box of tissues from a store clerk, whether you're interviewing a prospective employee, whether you're the employee trying to get the job from the boss, whether you're talking to your four-year-old son, whether your mother-in-law is asking something of you, you just look into the person's eyes and on a very deep level say, who are you and what is it that you're trying to accomplish? And sometimes that phrase, what are you trying to accomplish, is also an extremely interesting way to work with people. I had a couple of close friends who I also worked with that I could never seem to get along with. And I finally realized it was because their way of accomplishing their goals was so extremely different than me. And then I ended up contradicting their plans a lot. And one day, at Swami Kriyananda's suggestion, when the man called me with the next discussion we had to have about something, I tried very deeply inside myself to just ask the question, what is he trying to accomplish? Not what is he saying to me, but what is he trying to accomplish? And then I began to think how I could add my understanding to help him accomplish what he was trying to accomplish. It seems so simple. And I started actually working with Swami Kriyananda the same way. It's like he's my spiritual teacher, but we did a lot of work together. And instead of either mindlessly obeying him or endlessly rebelling against his authority, I would just ask myself, what is he trying to accomplish? And it's either a personal objective. Why is my wife nagging me like this? What is she trying to accomplish? Why is my boss ragging me like this? What is he trying to accomplish? Why are my parents urging this on me? What are they trying to accomplish? And then you relate to a reality larger than your own. And the management, as I was saying, of all of this is really the management of your own heart. You know, the having the charity of heart to really consider another person's reality, having the calmness of spirit to not react immediately but to pay attention. And I live in a community of people, and I have now for many decades, who seriously follow this way of relating because of the example of our spiritual founder. We do it in our business, we do it in our homes, we do it in our schools. It's so simple. And it not only changes your relationships with everyone else, but it not only accomplishes a great deal as a group, but it changes your own inner relationship with everyone. Because here we are, we're in it together. I have had the opportunity to talk to a lot of different people, and everybody is lovable if you just give them a chance. Swami Kriyananda put it on the basis of everybody is seeking the same thing, which is everybody wants to be happy. And we develop the strangest coping mechanisms. You know, we develop these odd personalities and these funny looks on our faces and this strange way of talking. But if you become quiet, especially inwardly quiet, and actually just try to find that person's deeper nature, everybody becomes lovable because there's that sincere and inner longing. And honestly, this works as well in a business context as it does in a home context. Because even then, if you have to fire someone or reprimand them strongly or tell them their work is inadequate, you know, if they feel that you have seen them, then everything becomes easier after that. Even if the message is difficult, you know you're delivering the message from a place of true maturity. I'm not the only one out here acting out my job in this way. I had one more thought. Let me see if I can remember it. Well, it slipped my mind at the moment. May I ask if there's any questions? Or comments or thoughts? This is a subject that usually elicits a few protestations.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
When you say, what are you trying to accomplish? You're looking into a person's eye.
Yeah.
You know, that's my feeling. Your mind runs in so many different ways, you know, and sometimes it goes towards the negative part as well. How do you control it? It's easier said than done.
You're speaking of your own mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? That's where the word managing really comes in. The biggest difficulties always are from our own hearts. And that has to become a separate commitment. You can't just work in an outward way.
You can't just try to do these things if you don't have the inward calmness to do them. Very simple. One of the simplest meditation methods is the breath. One of the simplest ways to calm your mind is the breath. There is an extremely close relationship between breath and thought. If you see bad actors in movies or television, whenever they're trying to be agitated or afraid, they're always breathing hard like that, like that. Because that's what you think of when people are upset, right? And whenever you are really concentrating on something, you'll actually realize, or even if, like, just a moment ago, where was that thought, I said. And just for a moment, I don't breathe at all. I mean, because you naturally hold your breath if you're really trying to concentrate. And if you're really concentrated, you find your breath is really steady. So when your mind begins to race, you can influence the racing of your mind by controlling your breath. When I was a young wife and used to get upset more often than I do now, I discovered that if I did calm, rhythmic breathing, then my emotions would calm down. I discovered that it was impossible to weep, to cry, and breathe calmly and rhythmically at the same time. The first time I found that out, I started breathing really deeply and I immediately stopped crying. But I really wanted to cry, so I stopped breathing like that because it was way too effective. So if you are talking to someone and you really want to tune in, just do a measured breathing where you're, or just even just watch your breath, just flowing up and down. And you'll notice that if your mind is restless, your breath is restless. Your breath is restless, it staggers, is how my friend said. Just a friend of mine is doing an art project on the sound of breath. Interesting. And a multimedia art project. And she was telling me she recorded her own breath. She was amazed how it just completely reflected her state of mind. Just completely. So use it in reverse. Oh, here's my state of mind. And see, that you can do. You're just sitting in your office. You're talking to one of your colleagues. Nobody knows anything that you're doing, but you use your concentration to make your breath flow, and you'll suddenly find that everything will become more still. If you raise your eyes slightly also, the subconscious mind is when the eyes are down. The conscious mind is when your eyes are straight. Superconscious, your eyes are raised slightly. So if you're in a situation where you're not having to look at someone, look at the upper corner of the room and simultaneously start watching your breath. And you find that both of those tiny little gestures, which you can do anywhere almost, will just begin to... And then when your mind gets agitated, you'll see you've lost your breath at the same time. Now, that watching the breath can become a profound meditation also, but this is just a beginning step for it. Okay? Any other questions?
I have one more.
Yes.
You just mentioned that why am I allowing myself to get unhappy because of someone else's behavior? It might be your husband, any relationship. But then in such scenarios, are we expected to not expect anything from the people around us? I mean, is that the way that we remain so selfless that we really don't expect anything from any close ones, near and dear ones? Or how do we control that emotion?
Thank you. That's a thought I forgot. Very good. There's a very important word in human relationships, especially in the context of what I'm talking to you, and that word is the word appropriate. Appropriate is a very dynamic word in human relationships. Sometimes, from listening to what I'm saying like this, we think we should be allow everyone to run over us, we should always be nice, we should have, as you say, have no expectations, just let people do whatever they want, it's their business. No, we have a responsibility also to each other. Now, I was not exercising my responsibility in trying to force my husband to forego his own sense of personal development and embrace my idea of it. That was not an appropriate expectation on my part. However, if anyone in your life, but in that particular case, he was not it being inappropriate to me. But people can behave inappropriately to you. They're bullying you, they're immoral in their behavior, they're dishonest, they're not conscientious in their work,
There's lots of times when people are not doing that which they ought to do, even though they're confused enough to think it's a good idea to behave that way. We have a responsibility to respond appropriately. And if the appropriate response is, I will not tolerate that kind of rudeness from you, then that's the right response, because you can't let someone think that they can mistreat you all the time and you're just going to be nice about it. That's not appropriate. You wouldn't, if you're raising a child, you would show the child the appropriate consequences of their own behavior. The balance point here is to be calm enough in yourself to be impersonal in the way you evaluate it. And impersonal means that everybody is equal, including me. I too have rights and feelings in this situation. And if you're behaving in a way that really is not appropriate, I'm going to tell you so, but I will also tell you in an appropriate manner, right? All of this comes back. So my mind is racing, and how do I? And we have 60 minutes here. I've been working on this as a discipline for 45 years, and who knows how many lifetimes before that. So all that I can do in this is say, consider these realities. And when you start practicing them, you will discover what's making it impossible for you to do it. And then that will be the incentive to gain more mastery over wrong expectations, restless thoughts that blind me, ancient hurts in my heart that confuse me in the present, you know, forgiveness, all the different things that distort our relationships with each other. Right? Does that help? It doesn't solve it, it just answers it. It's very important to realize, though, the goal of human relationships is not to be nice. It's to be mature. And sometimes we're nice because we have not experienced enough true maturity to have the courage to be truthful and appropriate. Sometimes nice is actually a lower level response. I mean, we can be nice because we are completely in mastery of ourselves and we recognize the situation and then we choose to be nice. Or we can be nice because it just is too frightening to be anything but nice. And that's not appropriate. You know, we have to have the courage of our own nature as well. And am I saying that this is easy? No. This is not easy. Is this worth doing? Absolutely. Because all we ever live in is this chaos of our own minds. And if we don't fix it, if we don't do something to fix it, it doesn't automatically get better. And, well, we all know the consequences of that. Yeah. I mean, I had a woman write to me. Her first question was, could I give her some healing techniques for her throat chakra? Because her throat was so bad now, she had trouble speaking and she could hardly sing. It was the first part of it, so I'm thinking, what could I offer? Then she tells me that the reason her throat is so messed up is from screaming at her teenage son, who is not paying any attention to her, and becoming more and more rebellious the more she screams. Wow, where do we begin? You know, you want to begin long before that. You want to start way earlier than that so you don't end up in that particular situation. But we all know those places, and We will not make the effort to change until the imagined misery of putting out the energy to change is less than the misery we are experiencing by staying as we are. And we learn from suffering. And in human relationships, that's our teacher. But it's an incentive to change. It's not a curse. That's the point. Yes.
I have one question. Uh-huh. When we experience this, or when we practice being nice or being patient, what I've experienced is many times we keep our true emotions in a vault.
Right.
And that is like, you know, growing, and how do we kind of let it go out?
Suppression is not the same as appropriate. Suppression is not the same as transformation. Suppression is having exactly the same feeling, but just not knowing what to do with it, so we just tighten up around it. The problem with suppression is it doesn't work. It's actually, even in the Gita, Krishna says, of what avail suppression? That's actually a line out of the Gita. It won't serve you. So what we have to, the first step is that we have to try to appreciate what it is that we're actually feeling. And if we have suppressed our feelings a lot, we don't always know. That's a practice. Sometimes you have to sit with a counselor or someone to help you. You have to find out what you really feel. You have to have enough courage to accept that maybe you have feelings that you're not proud of. You know, that my society, my family, my upbringing tells me I shouldn't feel this way. But if I do, I do. So the first thing is to shine enough light into your own reality that you know what it is. Then the next thing you have to do is you have to decide what is the appropriate response given how I feel. Because the appropriate response may or may not be to spread it out across the world, but it may be in fact that someone is treating you inappropriately and that your perception is simply accurate. Then comes courage to be able to honestly be who you are, present it to the world, and be able to stand steady enough with the inevitable result. And this is not a simple practice. But what happens if you don't is you get so, you build up such what I want to say is you're not current in your relationships. And when it does blow out, it blows out in such a confused way. Because somebody finally does something that causes you, and you give them 6 years of suppressed feeling, and all they did was just move the water bottle. And it's like, what is this about? Because it has nothing to do with the water bottle. The water bottle was just the last straw. Having lived through a little bit of that, both on the receiving and the giving end of it, staying current became really, really important to me. Because the little one is usually not nearly as bad as what happens if you don't. You know, suppression is like, it looks like a good idea because you don't have to deal with it. But when it catches up with you, it catches up with you in spades, or you get sick. It either blows out emotionally or it blows out physically. And so we just have to work. I mean, a lot of people who get really serious illnesses have huge emotional shifts because they see, oh, I know what made me sick. Is this easy? No. Is it worth it? Yes. Same answer. Okay? We have to help each other. Or you have to get people in your life who will help you. Yeah. Your colleagues at work may not be the ones because you're there to do work together, but your friends and your family can help you. Okay, any other questions or thoughts? All right then, I think we have spent our hour together. Thank you very much for coming. Bless you.